Iran reacts to the U.S. president's latest comments about global oil supply, saying that Washington has failed to remove Tehran from the international market. Tensions escalate between NATO and Russia over Ukraine, as the Western military alliance accuses Moscow of building up troops at Ukraine's border. And thousands of migrants are still stranded on the border between Poland and Belarus, as Polish troops refuse to allow them to cross the border. Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Mias. Thanks for joining us. Iran says the United States has tried for decades to remove the Islamic Republic from the international market, but it has failed to do so.
What Biden said indicates that no country can be eliminated from the international market. For decades, the Americans have tried to remove Iran from the global markets, but they have failed to do so due to the creativity of our youths who have overcome all obstacles.
Iran's foreign ministry spokesman said that the U.S. president has to be aware that Tehran is carefully monitoring his behavior. Saeed Khatibzadeh said that Tehran will go to the upcoming talks for the removal of sanctions with an eye on Joe Biden's actions and comments. Those talks are scheduled to be held in Vienna on November 29. On Friday, Biden said that there are sufficient supplies of petroleum worldwide so that other countries can cut their purchases from Iran. That is part of a policy that requires the White House to affirm every 6 months that there is enough supply, oil supply, globally, to maintain sanctions against Iran. The Islamic Republic argues that the sanctions are illegal. Writer and political analyst John White says the exploitive nature of U.S. relations with other countries is pushing the world towards the East.
Necessity dictates that the U.S. dollar should not be seen as a viable, as a secure and stable international currency, given the vicissitudes of Washington when it comes to its relations with all the countries and the powers in the region. So that it is pushing the world towards an Eastern resolve when it comes to dealing with the West. The West is no longer the only game in town. It had been from the demise of the Soviet Union in the early 1990s, but things have changed and changed utterly. So the world is looking to the East increasingly. China's Belt and Road Initiative is knitting vast swathes of the world together in a spirit of cooperation and mutual benefit. Whereas Washington is trying to still play by the old playbook of our game is the only game in town, and when we say jump, you say how high. This is no longer reality in the world.
Tensions flare up again between Moscow and the West, this time over Ukraine. NATO has accused Russia of taking aggressive actions by building up troops at Ukraine's border.
In recent weeks, we have seen large and unusual concentrations of Russian forces close to Ukraine's borders. Similar to Russia's build-up in Crimea and the Black Sea region earlier this year. Any further provocation or aggressive actions by Russia would be of serious concern.
The NATO chief stressed that the Western military alliance is standing by Kiev in the face of what he called large Russian military build-up at Ukraine's border. Ukraine has been locked in conflict with pro-independence fighters in the east since the Crimea Peninsula rejoined Russia in early 2014. Kiev and its Western allies accused Russia of sending troops and arms to support the fighters. Russia, however, rejects the allegations. It also accuses NATO of destabilizing the region by increasing its military activities there and sending military aid to Ukraine. The European Union has decided to impose fresh sanctions against Belarus amid deepening tensions with Minsk over a migrant crisis. The decision was made during a meeting of EU foreign ministers in Brussels, where they agreed to amend the 2020 sanctions against Belarus. Before the meeting, one of the ministers accused Minsk of violating human rights, saying severe economic sanctions against it is inevitable. The EU accuses Belarus of using migrants to reach its objectives against the bloc, an accusation that Minsk has dismissed as absurd. About 4,000 people have been stranded at the country's border with Poland. Warsaw has deployed additional guards at the border push back the migrants. A war of words is escalating between Belarus and the European Union over the migrant crisis at the border of the two countries. The situation is getting worse as temperatures are dropping below freezing, resulting in the deaths of several migrants. Hashtag Trending takes a look at social media reactions to the story.
Hey everyone. everyone. Welcome back to another Hashtag Trending with me, Ali Rıza. A humanitarian crisis is in the making at the Belarus-Poland border, where thousands of migrants are enduring freezing conditions. They are prevented from entering the European Union by Polish security forces. Stay with me to check out some social media reactions. The European Union accuses Belarus of endangering people's lives for political reasons, while Belarus and Russia accuse the bloc of showing hypocrisy for keeping the migrants out. Now, amid the blame game, temperatures at the border have dropped below freezing, resulting in the death of at least 7 migrants. Many have taken to social media to express sympathy with the desperate migrants who are stuck behind Polish borders. They say keeping these migrants in such terrible conditions just demonstrates the reality behind the so-called European democracy. Our first comment comes from Nexta. They wrote, "A large group of migrants go to the border. There are more and more migrants. They are not afraid of the cold or the terrible conditions in the camp. Their goal is to get into the EU at any cost and get to Germany." Pishti News wrote, "My heart cries out for these poor children. They throw tear gas at minors. It is really sad to see an innocent kid go through all this." Erdem Roni wrote, "Boundaries are cruel, so-called democracy in Europe." With winter approaching and frustrations rising amid the forests of West Belarus, there's growing alarm amid aid workers that the number of migrant deaths from exposure to freezing conditions will increase sharply. Ruptly tweeted, "Migrants pass Belarusian checkpoint at Kuznica border crossing." Our next tweet comes from Gapster. They wrote, "They have come a long way. If you were in their position, I bet you wouldn't stop trying. There's hardly a way to go back, and they need food too. There's no such thing as an easy solution." Helen tweeted, "Migrants at Polish border flock to collect wood as crisis continues." Some social media users compare the situation of migrants at the Polish border with the Afghanistan's refugee crisis, where neighboring Iran opened up its borders to receive as many Afghan refugees as it could. They also believe that the root cause of Europe's refugee crisis is Western military intervention in countries like Afghanistan, Syria, and Iraq. Our next comment comes from Ash Carl. He wrote, "The Afghanistan crisis is getting worse. More than 5.5 million internally displaced, over 682,000 this year alone. A severe winter, food shortages, and an economy in freefall. This migrant crisis is because the white racist imperialist terrorists destroyed these people's countries." Our final comment comes from Omran. He wrote, "For 20 years, hiding behind the U.S., the Europeans, particularly the low-life newcomers to murderous NATO, have massacred Afghans, Syrians, and Iraqis. Now the same scoundrels are denying their atrocities to avoid the price they must be blamed for, destroying the lives and livelihoods of the same disposed families." And with that, we have reached the end of this edition of Hashtag Trending. Until next time, take care and bye-bye.
Welcome back. Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan has accused Azerbaijani troops of intruding his country's territory. Pashinyan says he has also dismissed the country's defense minister over the incident. According to Armenia's Security Council, Azerbaijani troops surrounded 4 Armenian combat points on Sunday, but left the territory upon negotiations. Armenia also called on the international community to pay attention to what it described as Azerbaijan's ongoing aggressive actions at the border. The two neighbors have been locked in a dispute over Nagorno-Karabakh for decades. They fought a 6-week war over the region late last year, which left ethnic Armenians losing large parts of the territory. British police say that the deadly car explosion in the northwestern city of Liverpool was a terrorist incident.
Although the motivation for this incident is yet to be understood, given all the circumstances, it has been declared a terrorist incident, and counter-terrorism policing are continuing with the investigation.
The counter-terrorism police say that the explosive device was made by a taxi passenger who died in the blast. They say the identity of the passenger is believed to be known but cannot be disclosed. According to police, 4 men, all in their 20s, have been arrested in connection with the blast. The incident took place on Sunday morning when a cab exploded outside of the Liverpool Women's Hospital. Following the explosion, Britain's Interior Minister raised the country's terrorism threat level to severe meaning an attack is likely highly. Rohingya refugees in India are facing an alarming situation. The destitute community is scattered in many parts of the Indian subcontinent, and the conditions have further deteriorated amid growing Islamophobia and a vicious campaign calling for their expulsion. Our correspondent Munawwar Zaman has visited a refugee camp and has filed this report.
The violence in Myanmar was not enough for us, says the desperate woman upon our arrival. She says we are calling God in every possible way, but looks like our prayers are not being heard. She has many complaints, yet she can talk about the basic ones.
There is a huge list of problems that we are facing, but the major issue is every one of us has not received free COVID vaccination, and many had to spend their own money to get those. Another major hurdle is the lack of toilets for us and shortage of water supply. With regards to food, God sends many good people to feed us almost every day.
After fleeing war-ravaged Myanmar and what the UN described as ethnic cleansing, they are now trying to rebuild their shattered lives in different parts of India. But in India, they are sometimes called termites, sometimes illegal immigrants. Apparently, they are also accused of illegal activities, but these claims were not reflected in the recently released National Crime Records Bureau analysis.
Vasudeva Kutumbakam, which means the world is one family, sounds like an encouraging phrase. But looking at the living conditions of these refugees leads one to ask question whether the world has abandoned its responsibility towards them.
Rohingya refugees are struggling to survive in the world's largest democracy with enormous quantities of effort. Over the last few years, the community is in utter distress, sometimes detention in midnight raids, sometimes their camps being mysteriously burnt down. Regardless of the refugee crisis across the world, this particular community continues to be unseen victims of violence.
Since our camp was razed down by fire, we have relocated to this place, and it's a very difficult situation in terms of living in crumbling space. We are having shortage of water supplies. A tanker arrives and it finishes within an hour. Another major issue is snakes on this land and the lack of toilets for women.
Official estimates suggest more than 40,000 Rohingya Muslims have sought refuge in India after a brutal crackdown against their community in Myanmar. Many refugees say they felt safe in India since they arrived, but over the last few years, a vicious campaign against their expulsion is haunting the community.
A new report by the New York Times has revealed that the United States concealed the data about the number of civilian deaths in the 2019 air raid in Syria. The attack could be a possible war crime, as it killed dozens of women and children. But a thorough and independent investigation never happened.
A new report by The Times has revealed detail about one of the largest civilian casualty incidents in U.S. history. On 18th of March 2019, the U.S. military carried out an attack in the town of Baruz in eastern Syria. An F-15E attack jet targeted a crowd of people in Baruz with a 500-pound bomb. 5 minutes later, it dropped another even bigger bomb, and then another. Initial battle damage assessments put the death toll at around 70. The Times also revealed that following this strike, the U.S.-led coalition forces had bulldozered the blast site to cover up the incident. The U.S. military didn't publicly acknowledge the incident, and the death toll was downplayed. Finally, this week, U.S. Central Command acknowledged the attacks for the first time. It said 80 people were killed in the airstrike, including 16 Daesh terrorists and 4 civilians. However, saying it was not clear if the other 60 were civilians, it justified the killings by saying women and children might have been Daesh members. The report says the death toll was almost immediately apparent to the military officials. It said an Air Force lawyer present in the operation center at the time believed the attacks were possible war crimes, but regulations for investigating the potential crime were not followed.
Well, you know, in an ideal world, there would be a prosecution, there would be a trial and a proper hearing, but the way the world is run today, it's highly unlikely that the United States will, first of all, recognize any international court, and second of all, follow the judgment of such a court.
The admission was rather unusual, as more often civilian deaths are undercounted by the U.S. military, even in classified reports.
The U.S. is guilty of killing civilians in many war theaters like in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria, in drone strikes and other military operations. Rights groups have accused Washington of hiding the real number of civilian casualties and underreporting them. And West Asia is not the only region suffering from U.S. aggression. For example, civilian casualties occurred in the U.S. military's secret air war in Somalia, with no justice or reparation for the victims of possible violations of international humanitarian law.
Pentagon recently admitted that a drone strike in the Afghan capital Kabul on August 29th was a botched strike. It killed 10 civilians, including 7 children. The attack came amid the hasty withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan and days after a suicide bombing in Kabul International Airport that killed over 150 Afghans as well as 13 U.S. service members. New research from a London-based civilian harm monitoring group named Air Wars showed that since 2001, at least 22,679 civilians were killed in U.S. strikes across various theaters, including Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Somalia, Libya, Yemen, and Pakistan. The group said that the number of civilian deaths could be potentially as high as over 48,300.
Well, the fact is that if the world's so-called sole superpower can flex its muscles anywhere it chooses, regardless of the United Nations, regardless of international law, and regardless of public opinion worldwide, this gives the worst possible example to American allies, and that is follow the leader. If the United States can kill people at whim, at any place, at any time, then presumably its allies can do similar things.
Pakistan, in particular, has been the victim of U.S. drone strikes. The U.S. began its attacks in 2004 to kill Al-Qaeda and Taliban forces. There are questions about how many civilians have been killed as a result of these strikes. According to the highest estimates, these strikes have killed thousands of people. The U.S. military, from CENTCOM to the Department of Defense, does not provide official estimates of civilian deaths, nor have they published such findings. Nearly 1,000 strikes hit targets in Syria and Iraq in 2019 using 4,729 bombs and missiles. The official military tally of civilian death for that entire year is only 22, and the strikes from March 18 are nowhere on the list.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the very heart of evergreen forests. Under the starry sky of the desert. With the radiance of silver-colored sand. In the midst of proud mountains. Closer, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. God, oh, I'm late. I might miss the flight. The traffic was very heavy. My ticket. Where is my ticket? Oh, I found it. Here it is. Oh. To find the check-in gate for my flight. I'm going to take a trip to Dezful, and after that, I'm going to visit the city of Shush. Today, I'm going to visit Shush Museum. Shush, or Susa, is a city located in Khuzestan province in southwestern Iran. Shush is one of the most ancient cities in the world. This city is 24 kilometers away from Dezful. The ancient city of Shush is the capital of thousands-year-old Elamite civilization. This city has also been the winter capital of Achaemenid Empire. Shush Museum has some of the important treasures that have been discovered during the excavations of this city. Shush Museum is located near Acropole Hill, which is one of the most important archaeological sites of the world. Many of the objects that were discovered during the excavations of this hill are now kept in Shush Museum. This museum is located near Shush Castle, which is known as the French Castle, because it used to be inhabited by French archaeologists for a while. Shush Museum has 6 halls, 4 big halls, and 2 small halls. The 4 big halls of Shush Museum keep the relics of Elamite, Achaemenid, Parthian, and Sasanid eras. Oh, I finally reached the beautiful city of Shush. Now I'm waiting for a taxi, which is going to take me to Shush Museum. To be honest, I'm really excited because I don't know what unique things I'm going to see at Shush Museum. And now I am in the big garden of Shush Museum. The building of the museum is a beautiful brick-made structure and is located in the middle of the garden. The walls around the garden are short, yet the trees in here are tall. They're taller than the walls. Here, there are pomegranate trees, palm trees, eucalyptus trees, and jujube. Some of the statues or archaeological relics are kept in glass showcases. Their characteristics are written on a metal plate. Oh, look at here. Here is a big stone statue of an animal which has its tail stuck to its body. I don't know what kind of animal it is. It's amazing anyway. And a few meters away, there are the columns of Apadana Palace. And I am now inside the museum. Just in front of me, there is the statue of Hercules. It's Hercules standing calm, squeezing a lion's neck with his hands. What a wonderful statue! It belongs to the Parthian era. And here, there is the statue of a winged horse. This horse has been discovered from the Apadana Palace, yes. Oh well, this museum is full of unique things which have no pair anywhere in the world. Some of them include Elamite and Parthian head sculptures, stone inscriptions with Sumerian alphabets, sculptures of animals' heads, so many wares and decorative objects and armbands, etc. Well, describing these ancient objects needs time, and I suggest you to travel to the city of Shush and visit this great museum.
Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now let's listen to Sheikh Salim Bimji.
We continue in the theme that we have been going over the last four nights, which is dealing with temporal strife through living a Quranic life. And again, the goal of this series is to recognize the fact that we go through difficulties in life, not only in this COVID-19 era, but our entire lives are full of challenges. We have many difficulties and ups and downs that we go through in life at a personal level, at a community level, at the level of the country that we live in. The goal is, however, to recognize these challenges and to use the Quran as our guide. Obviously, the Quran as taught to us by the Prophet and his Ahlul Bayt, alayhim wassalatu wassalam, and the ulama, the Shia ulama, who have dedicated their lives to understanding and explaining the Quran throughout the ages. Tonight, the topic that I want to reflect upon is the deception of this world. So, how does a believer look at this world? With what glasses do we use to analyze and understand the dunya that we live in? Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, being the creator of you and I, He didn't just create us and leave us on earth without a manual. You know, today you go and buy any product. You buy a television, you buy your smartphone, you buy anything that you buy today in the store or online. Chances are they have a user manual. Either it's in the box or you go online and you download it. And that manual was created by the company or a department within the company that will show you how to safely use that product. How to plug it in, how to charge the battery, how to set different functionality in it, and so on and so forth. Well, we as human beings came with a manual, the Quran. And we came with a teacher to teach us the manual, because sometimes, as those of you who are in school or have been to school, you'll know that you will get a textbook at the beginning of your year, whether it's math class or science or English or social studies. And a teacher will be there to teach you the book. You can read the text. You're not a fool. You've learned how to read English. But the teacher is there to teach you what's not necessarily written between the lines. He or she will guide you through the coursework, through the material, through the exercises. And then they'll teach you more than that is not necessarily in the book that they have learned from experience. So the Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt, alayhim wassalam, are the same for us. Allah didn't just give us the book. He says, وَيُعَلِّمُهُمُ الْكِتَابَ وَالْحِكْمَةِ, that the Prophet teaches the book and the wisdom to us and teaches us what we could never know, what we didn't have the ability to understand. You know, this reminds me of the story of the time of the seventh Imam, Imam Musa ibn Ja'far, and the event that happened to him when he was in Baghdad, Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam. Many of us have, I'm sure, been to his beautiful shrine in Kadhimiyah, where him and his and the ninth Imam are buried. There's a story that I'm sure we've all heard, but I just want to repeat it for those who have never come across it, about a man named as known as Bishr al-Hafi. This is a nickname he took on. Bishr, we are told in this story, one day was having a party in his house. He had haram music playing. He had girls, women who were dancing and singing for him. It was what we would call a party in today's day and age. Live music, dancing, haram mixing between men and women, so on and so forth. It just so happens that in a short time period when Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam was out of prison, because as we know, he spent most of his life in house arrest and in the jails of the Abbasid Khulafa, lanatullah alayhim ajma'in. He was released for a time period. One day he's walking in the streets of Baghdad. And right at that same time, out of the house of Bishr came the servant. She was one of the servants in the house, and it was a party going on. So she had a lot of garbage that she had collected. She brought it out to throw it outside. Now it so happened as the Imam is walking by, this servant of the house comes out of the house with the garbage bin. The Imam sees her. And the Imam obviously hears the music playing. He hears the women dancing and clapping and singing and whatever they're doing, whatever debauchery they're involved in. And after saying salam to this servant of the home, the Imam asks, the seventh Imam asks this woman, he says that, is the owner of this house hur or an abd? Is he a free man or a slave? Now the Imam obviously had a different meaning that he wanted to get over to this individual, but she says, no, he's a free man. He's hur. He's free. And so the Imam tells her, he says that, yes, you're right, he is free. Because had he been an abd of Allah, he would not be involved in all of this dunya, this temporal world, the delusion that he has been put, that he has put himself into. So apparently this conversation took a few minutes. The imam left, went on his way walking in the streets of Baghdad, and the servant, she went back in the house. Bishr asks her, why did it take you so long to throw the garbage out? You just had to throw it out and come back in. It doesn't take you 4 or 5 minutes. And she told him what happened, that she met this man, and she said the man asked her a question. And Bishr asked her, what did he ask you? And she says, he asked me, is the owner of this house Hur or an Abd? Is he a free man or a slave? And I told him that he's free. And then she told Bishr that, you know what, he said that, yes, if he was a slave of Allah, if he was a slave and Abd, he would not act in this way. Bishr, who had, again, been involved in all of this haram and caught up in the world, he recognized that this was a wise man. And he recognized that this was not a normal person or a scholar or just a regular person of Baghdad. He knew who this man was who said these words. And so historians say he ran out of the house as fast as he could to find the seventh imam. He ran. He found him, and he actually did tawbah. He did istighfar to Allah. He asked Allah at the hand of the imam for forgiveness. And he did this barefooted, no shoes on, no socks. And that's why he was called Bishr al-Hafi. Al-Hafi meaning the one who was barefooted, because he ran out barefooted to meet the imam, to apologize, to ask Allah for forgiveness for being caught up in this dunya. And actually, we're told in the books of history that he never wore shoes after that day. He lived his entire life shoeless, to remind him of the sin he did on that day and what he had to do to repent for that action. Now let me end in these last few moments, brothers and sisters, with one hadith to get us to better balance our lives, so we don't become deluded by the world, nor do we go to another extreme of becoming, you know, completely so religious that we forget about the life of this dunya, that we balance the world that we have. Again, Amir al-Mu'mineen, the commander of the faithful, Ali ibn Abi Talib, may God's peace and blessings be upon him and his family forever, he says in a hadith, لَيْسَ مِنَّا مَنْ تَرَكَ دُنْيَاهُ لِآخِرَتِهِ وَلَا آخِرَتَهُ لِدُنْيَاهُ. You are not to be called as one who is with us, the Ahlul Bayt. You're not our follower if you leave the dunya and only focus on the akhirat, or you leave the akhirat and only focus on the dunya, the temporal material world. Meaning that we have to come to a balance. We don't let the world delude us. We don't let the deluders delude us. But we live in the world. We make use of this, what Allah has given us. We make use of the games, the entertainment to a limit. We make use of the zina, the beauties Allah has given to us, to a limit. We work to gather money to a limit. All of these things have to be within our limits. We don't go to excess in any of these areas. We don't become so deluded by the dunya that we forget the world, that we forget the world to come, rather. We balance both of these. We recognize our true purpose in life, and then we move on to recognize the fact that we are created by Allah. We will go back to Allah. And as the verse of Surah Al-Hadid mentioned, and I'll end with this last sentence, is that as we live in this world, as we go to school, as we get education, as we get a job eventually, as we get married eventually, as we have children eventually, we do all of this keeping in mind that we are seeking maghfiratun min Allah, the forgiveness from Allah, wa ridwan. Even more than that is the ridwan of Allah, the pleasure of Allah. Because the pleasure of Allah, that is the best thing we could ever get from Allah, my brothers and sisters.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahim Kareem شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
Hundreds of campaigners representing indigenous communities, young people, and civil society groups recently poured into the hallways of the venue of COP, chanting, "Keep 1.5 degrees Celsius alive," and condemning political leaders for failing to deliver an agreement that will limit global heating to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels by the end of the century. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Julia Conley, journalist. This article is titled, "Leaders at COP26 are massively killing the Paris Agreement," critics say. Stay tuned for more. Hundreds of campaigners representing indigenous communities, young people, and civil society groups recently poured into the hallways of the venue of COP26, chanting, "Keep 1.5 degrees Celsius alive," and condemning political leaders for failing to deliver an agreement that will limit global heating to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels by the end of the century. Advocates called the demonstration a people's plenary and proceeded out into the street for a rally with members of Extinction Rebellion and Fridays for Future. "This is the real atmosphere of people fighting for their needs," Katarzyna Niemer, a climate activist from Poland, told the Washington Post. Despite warnings from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, and climate scientists around the world that allowing the Earth's temperature to rise above the 1.5 degrees Celsius threshold will lead to irreversible damage to the environment and will prove deadly for people in frontline communities across the globe, experts say the negotiations during the COP26 have put the planet on track for warming between 1.8 degrees Celsius and 2.5 degrees Celsius. Climate justice advocates, including the campaign group Corporate Accountability, expressed outrage at the lack of equity, urgency, and ambition by world leaders and wealthy nations. Climate action means rejecting big polluter schemes like carbon markets, paying up for loss and damage, and advancing real solutions like making polluters pay, tweeted Corporate Accountability recently. While pledging to keep 1.5 alive, said Corporate Accountability, leaders have failed to deliver on any meaningful pathway to do so. The group added, "The deal on the table is a death sentence for millions of those on the front lines." Campaigners condemned the leaders' insistence on including language that leaves the door open for techno-fixes and false solutions like carbon capture technology. "The draft decision is massively killing the Paris Agreement," said Mina Raman of Third World Network and Friends of the Earth Malaysia. "No finance, no technology transfer, no adaptation, no loss and damage." As Common Dreams reported recently, countries in the global south not only face an existential threat from extreme weather events brought on by the climate emergency in the coming years, illustrated by Tuvalu Foreign Minister Simon Kofe, who addressed the summit standing in knee-deep water, but also are expected to lose an average of 20% of their gross domestic product in the next three decades, and 64% by 2100 if the 1.5 degrees Celsius threshold is crossed. Meanwhile, a $100 billion annual funding pledge made by wealthy countries with the aim of helping developing nations mitigate the climate crisis is now scheduled to be delivered starting in 2023, 3 years late. The draft text noted with deep regret the failure to provide the funding and called for a doubling of funds by 2025. But leaders have not reached an agreement on providing new financing to help with the damage that has already been done. The text included language calling only for a technical assistance facility to aid countries that have suffered losses and damages. The wealthiest have said that their coffers are empty, treating climate finance as if it were some loose change to be found down the back of the sofa, said Assad Rahman of War on Want. In 2021, this new text may have plenty of warm words to acknowledge and urge when what we really needed was will, and what we needed when your house is on fire. and for those trapped in that fire, not for us to acknowledge that there is a fire or that we should ring the fire brigade, but to actually act.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The birth of the Holy Prophet, the beginning of a new era in human life. This is a part of a speech delivered on October 24th, 2021, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic and foreign participants in the 35th International Islamic Unity Conference.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. All praise is due to God, the Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master Muhammad, upon his pure, immaculate household, upon his chosen companions, and upon the followers until the Day of Judgment. I welcome all of you, dear participants, particularly the honorable guests who have come for the Islamic Unity Conference, and the brothers who have come to this meeting from other countries. I would like to congratulate you on this auspicious anniversary of the birth of the esteemed Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi, and also the blessed anniversary of the birth of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, which took place in the year 83 of the Hijri calendar, on the same day that the Holy Prophet was born. The birth of the Holy Prophet was in fact the beginning of a new era in human life. It was a sign of the beginning of a new era of divine will and divine favors for humanity. Therefore, this birth is a very great event. The greatness of the birth of the Holy Prophet truly cannot be described in ordinary words. This is a very big incident.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Some people have described it in the language of art and poetry, which is one way of portraying this event. One example of such poetry is the following. Guidance was born, so the world was lit up, and smiles and admiration settled upon the lips of time. The language of art speaks in this way. Guidance was born, light rained upon the universe, the lips of time opened with a smile and praise. The greatness of this incident can be understood to a certain extent with such descriptions. This is an important event. The greatness of the event of the birth of the Holy Prophet equals the greatness of his status. His great status in creation is such that from the beginning to the end of creation, the exalted God has not created another being as great as the Holy Prophet. The responsibility that God placed on his shoulders is just as great. Because of this great responsibility, God says, Allah did confer a great favor on the believers when he sent among them an apostle from among themselves. Quran, Surah 3, verse 164.
Of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.